Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, a history of civilization in blood and brick, with historian David Fry and his book Walls.
David Fry is a professor and historian whose research has taken him around the world and involved him in numerous archaeological digs since receiving his PhD from Duke University. He has published extensively in international academic journals, and David is now the author of a book, Walls, A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick. David, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you, Neil.
What's the idea behind Walls?
Well, the idea behind the book is that it actually hadn't been done yet. You know, there are people that had written about modern borders and, you know, a handful of the better known walls, obviously Hadrian's Wall in England. And there were works on the Great Wall of China and some of its predecessors. But no one had ever written a global history of walls. And, you know, as it turns out, they are a global phenomenon. And I don't mean just today. They always have been. And whether we're talking about city walls or border walls, you find them across Europe and Asia, and you find them in North Africa, Central and South America. So most every continent was given to wall building at one time or another. And it occurred to me that that might be a very important thing, that millions of people, hundreds of millions of people had lived behind walls, and that tens of millions of people, at the very least, had helped construct those walls. But very little attention had ever been paid to it. And so, the idea behind the book was to look into that and find out, how did these walls help shape history, or did they?
And the subtitle of the book is A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick. And, you know, the idea of civilization obviously crops up a lot through it. And so we have this sort of divide between people who are living behind walls and people who live outside the walls. And the people that are living behind the walls are basically hiding from the people on the outside. So let's talk about first who those people are, because obviously they're also people. The word civilization obviously is referring to the city-states that sort of grew up. Who was outside?
Okay, well, in the book, I talk about wallers and warriors, the wallers being the people you were referring to as the insiders in the city-states. The warriors were altogether different from them. These were societies where there were no civilian occupations, and there was no concept of civilian in general. Every man was a warrior. The measure of a man was his skill in battle. And it seems that that sort of society was required in a world which faced constant insecurity, that the men were the only defense for those communities. And so they didn't apply themselves to other things. They didn't become workers. They didn't become writers and philosophers and mathematicians. They became soldiers. And in many of those societies, there wasn't even a word for soldier. The word for man sufficed. because it went without saying that every boy from a very young age was trained to withstand pain, trained to endure frightening conditions, trained to be able to fight with weapons. So that was especially, I would say, in Eurasia, that was the nature of the sort of societies that existed outside the walled world of the city-states.
And those people, I mean, in a lot of cases, obviously had chosen to pursue that type of lifestyle. Obviously, within the cities, there was stratification of classes. Obviously, there was somebody who ran the place and there were slaves, you know, but the people on the outside were not just people that had been barred from civilization. They had, to some extent, chosen to pursue that nomadic lifestyle. How did that divergence happen, do you think?
Well, and I would say chose to maintain that lifestyle for a very long time. You know, in particular, in the case of the equestrian nomadic societies of the Eurasian steppe, this proved to be a lifestyle that was apparently uniquely satisfactory to people such as the Huns and the Mongols, the Turks, and all the various subdivisions of those groups. So that, you know, that lifestyle went unchanged for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, actually, which put it in stark contrast again with the world of, the city-states.
Let's talk about the first walls then. So at this point where people start to settle down in the first cities around Mesopotamia, you paint this vivid picture of these people frantically knowing that there's this sort of danger from the outside, from the barbarians that are always at the gate, frantically building and rebuilding walls out of mud, almost pointlessly, because they just erode away anytime, you know, when there's a seasonal rain, the floods blow these walls away. Tell us about the first time these sort of defensive walls appear.
Well, there were two types of defensive walls. There were the city walls, and then ultimately there were also border walls. The city walls are much older, and the first instance we know of city walls are nearly 12,000 years ago, and that was in the city of Jericho, which would be in the modern country of Jordan. As far as border walls go, now, they come much later. There's some evidence for a 3rd millennium BC border wall in Syria, but the earliest border wall that, you know, our literary sources attest to, and that, you know, we're fairly certain about when it happened, was one built in the kingdom of Ur by a king named Shulgi around 2000 BC.
We've mentioned this division between the people who choose to live behind the walls, choose to live in some sort of civilization, and those who make the explicit decision to live the warrior lifestyle outside. And there are many places where this is more explicit than in Greece, between the Greeks and the Spartans. Tell us about the Spartan ideal.
The Spartans were very nearly unique in the ancient world. You know, in antiquity, a city was a thing with walls. And in fact, you find that in Greece, but you also find that in China and Egypt. You know, in Egypt, the hieroglyphic symbol for for a city was a wall with a crossroads inside. The Spartans refused to wall their city, and it was a matter of principle for them. They felt that walls, and in fact, the sort of civilized lifestyle that flourished inside walls, they felt that that sapped them of, or would sap them of their virility. And so, you know, whenever a group of Spartan soldiers would be marching past a walled city, they would look at it and sort of scoff. And they had this joke that they repeatedly made, you know, what sort of women live in there? Referring not to the women inside the city, but to the men who they felt had been made effeminate by a walled lifestyle. So the Spartans refused to wall their city and instead felt that they should be defended by walls of men. But in order to do that, they had to radically remake their society. They had to adopt something closer to the barbarian lifestyle, where they rejected, you know, what they regarded as the luxuries and the superfluous arts of civilization, and instead deliberately lived a rougher lifestyle, you know, wearing fewer clothes and, you know, becoming accustomed to dark dark and cold and hunger and, less fine foods and the like. And it was all part of this toughening process that enabled them to defend their city with walls of men. So they really stood out in the Greek world for that decision. Now, that being said, they were unusual in that they actually acted on that impulse. The impulse itself or the belief that walls and civilization softened people didn't originate with the Spartans. It was a very old idea, and certainly you see traces of it in the Old Testament and you see it in the Gilgamesh epic. So what really made them stood out was being willing to walk the walk rather than merely talk the talk, as they say.
All of these early societies, you know, the original civilization growing in the Fertile Crescent, the old cities in Mesopotamia, Greece, and indeed Rome, all have in common is their proximity to the enormous Eurasian steppe, which is this, you know, wasteland that's in the main occupied by these barbarian hordes. And right at the far side of that, as you've already have alluded to, is China. Now, everybody's heard of the Great Wall, but the Great Wall is just one of many defensive walls that were built up over the years in China. What was earlier walls there like?
So, you know, wall building in China is very old, as it is in other parts of the world. Going back to the third millennium BC, they're building walls even around their villages. And these walls, which were made of tamped earth, could be as much as 80 feet wide. 80 feet wide walls, Lord knows they expected to be used against them, at that time. But so city walls were with the Chinese from the start. And as early as 800 BC, we have sources indicating that the first border walls are being constructed by smaller Chinese states. Now, that's before there is a single Chinese state, and that China as an empire, as a single state, is formed in the late 3rd century BC, really, by their first emperor. And that is coincident with the building of the first of what you might call the Great Walls. In Chinese history, it's known as the Long Wall. And it was, it was at least 1,000 miles long and maybe as many as 6,000 miles long. And whereas we know that wall didn't last, it set a precedent for wall building that generations upon generations of Chinese emperors would follow. So, it was a sort of the endless responsibility of peasants to be working on these walls, something they very much resented. I have to say, there's folk songs and poems that record the opinions of the Chinese peasants who were being drafted into these forced labor corvées to do all this work. And I think they would rather have been attacked by the barbarians in the end.
I just wanted to talk about one figure in China at this time. That's Zhang Chen, who basically is a person that, well, I guess discovered that there was, went off and journeyed into that great steppe and discovered that there was actually civilizations on the other side that were basically facing the same issues as those sort of Chinese civilizations were, and so opened up those empires to each other. Tell us more about who he was.
Okay, so Zhang lived around 100 BC. So this was, the Chinese state was about a century old at the time, and certainly the Long Wall still existed. But the Long Wall had its limits, and so he went venturing into some of the wastelands outside of China, and in particular into the Taklamakan Desert. Taklamakan is a Turkish word meaning go in and you won't come out. And, I believe in India, they refer to it as the Great Sand Ocean. And, various languages have names for this desert. None of them are particularly promising. But once he is able to, make it south of the desert, he discovers this world of cities that the Chinese never knew existed. And these would be what would become the Silk Road cities. Tashkent, Bukhara, Samarkand. So, you know, they become very, almost fabled in a way. But at the time, it's stunning to the Chinese to discover that there's a world of people out there who culturally are so much like them that they too live behind walls and, you know, have these civilian economies. And so when he finally is able to return home and, you know, report on his discoveries to the Emperor Wu, there's a tremendous amount of excitement. Oddly enough, some of that excitement has to do with the discovery of these horses that allegedly sweat blood. And apparently that's a real thing, that, you know, those horses actually existed or perhaps still do. And, you know, the desire to make contact with these people was so strong, though, that they ended up extending the Long Wall much further to the west so that travelers from China and eventually even armies from China, but, you know, especially traders would be able to, you know, make the trip to Central Asia without having to fear the raids of the Huns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to David Fry. We're talking about his book, Walls, A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick. And David, I want to spend some time talking about the Romans and their changing attitudes over the years to defensive walls. You mentioned Hadrian's Wall. You've actually dug there yourself in your career, and it's a place that I've visited myself many times. I'm very familiar with some of the places that you've actually dug. Hadrian's Wall was one of many fortifications that the Emperor Hadrian built during his reign. Why was he so keen on the defensive walls?
You know, the question of why is one I can't actually answer. I try to be very careful as a historian not to leap too far into speculation. Our ancient biographies of Hadrian are sketchy at best, and so they don't give us, real insight into his thinking. But, you know, I can say that it does seem to have represented something of a change in Roman policy, that his immediate predecessor, the Emperor Trajan, was much more offensive-minded. And, you know, when he had to deal with problems, you know, in southeastern Europe, you know, he went on the offense into Dacia. And Hadrian's attitude was very different, and it's Hadrian that, you know, attempts to gird as much of the empire as he can with walls. Obviously, he does it most famously in England, but, you know, there are similar Hadrianic walls in North Africa, and some evidence that he was perhaps doing some work in Southeast Europe and perhaps even Western Asia as well.
You mentioned the finding at the Vindolanda Forts by Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland of writing tablets, this famous find that basically gave us an insight, first of all, into the sort of people that were there manning the wall, but also what they thought about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So Vindolanda is a fort found near Hadrian's Wall, and it was originally constructed and occupied prior to the building of Hadrian's Wall, but then, you know, it remained there for quite some time. In the early 1970s, they first started discovering writing tablets there, and these were, you know, little slivers of wood upon which Roman soldiers had written, in some cases, letters home, in other cases, duty rosters and things of that sort in ink. And so these have become invaluable, you know, in terms of understanding the Roman frontier, because, you know, as a historian, one of the frustrating things about, you know, exploring the past and, you know, especially, say, the Roman past is we know so much about the capital and the great cities like Athens and Ephesus, but we know so little about the frontier because people out there generally aren't writing the books, and, you know, what they did write didn't survive. So this is a wonderful thing that we have these tablets. And it reveals to us a lot about, I think, you know, not just life on the wall, but about, you know, again, going back to this question of the wallers and warriors. The Romans had been a society of wallers for some time, even before the building of Hadrian's Wall, to the extent that, for example, Rome itself was a walled city. And like most walling peoples, they prefer not to fight their own battles. They prefer to hire outsiders from warrior societies to fight for them. And that's certainly the case up at Vindolanda, where they have brought in various foreign troops from Belgium and Holland to Tungrians and Batavians to help defend the wall. But it's interesting that, you know, they're hiring these individuals because, you know, they come from societies which it's more normal for, you know, a young man to become a soldier or a mercenary. And yet they arrive at the wall, and reading these letters, you can see they're already in the process of being changed, that they're becoming used to a level of organization and having workloads put on them that never would have happened back in their homeland. But they're, you know, they're used to standing there and for roll call and, you know, being counted off for duty rosters. They're used to being assigned tasks like, you know, working in the quarry or whatnot. And these sorts of things would have been very new to them. So, it's part of the process of their transformation, I think.
And I mean, I won't ask you whether or not this softening up behind the city walls, you know, directly contributed to the fall of Rome, because, you know, whole books could be written about that and no doubt have. But clearly we can see patterns developing between, you know, this time and the fall of Rome of, you know, a softening up and then a sacking and then a new emperor who's more martial in their sort of ideas, the hiring again of mercenaries from the outside. It just becomes repeated on and on.
Yeah. And, you know, and oddly enough, it doesn't even take us, you know, to look at it retrospectively to even speculate on this, you know, what you're calling a softening up process. You know, for the Romans themselves recognized it and, you know, sometimes praised it and sometimes criticized it. You know, shortly after Hadrian, there is an oration by a Roman named Aristides, and he is speaking before the emperor Antoninus Pius, and he is celebrating the world of the empire. He's celebrating the world behind the walls, and he's saying it's become a kind of paradise because the Romans don't even remember what war was. They have come to doubt that wars ever actually even happened. And instead, they have these carefree lives where they go to libraries and baths and gymnasiums. And he says it's all possible because we have these walls, which are defended far, far away by so many soldiers that, you know, an arrow couldn't even pass through them. So he's describing what you might call the softening up of the empire, but in a very positive way. You know, we're becoming more civilized and you know, we're enjoying life. Once the walls have failed or the borders have been breached by invaders, you start to see different opinions on that. And later in the book, I talk, for example, about a bishop named Synesius, unusual man of the cloth. He is a very two-fisted sort of priest in a way. He fancies himself a descendant of the ancient Spartans. And so he's determined that, you know, the Romans should rearm themselves and they shouldn't allow people to be loafing about, you know, the sports stadiums anymore, that everyone should take up arms. And it's the opposite of what Aristides was praising a couple of centuries earlier. So it is interesting that those ideas were, in fact, being tossed around, you know, more than 1,000 years ago.
And so people keep building walls and cities keep falling. And you spent some time talking about, you know, we've talked about some of the various groups that are barbarian groups that have assailed these civilizations, but none of them really held a candle to Genghis Khan, who truly brings these a lot of these civilizations down finally. But jumping forwards a bit, I want to bring us right up to the siege of Constantinople in 1453. And suddenly there is, you know, regardless of who it is attacking these walls, suddenly there is a technology that is going to make these walls more redundant.
Right. So cannons had been around before 1453. And, you know, they've been in use since the 1300s. But, you know, the early cannons were small and not particularly effective. So in 1453, the Turkish leader, Mehmed II, is fulfilling a lifelong goal of taking the city of Constantinople from the Christians. And so he ends up being able to hire a Hungarian foundryman, whose name was Orban. And Orban had, in fact, offered his services as a cannon maker to, you know, the last emperor of Constantinople, Constantine XI. And Constantine couldn't pay him or couldn't pay him enough. So, you know, he's something of a mercenary and he sells his services to Mehmed II. And then he begins work on this enormous cannon that he is designing to bring down the walls of Constantinople, which have stood for more than 1,000 years and have twice held off enormous Arabic armies. I spent months working on it. Ironically, they're doing this in a city about 100 miles away from Constantinople called Adrianople, which is, you know, the ancient city of Hadrian. So the city of the great wall builder is now going to give birth to the destroyer of walls. And the destroyer of walls is one heck of a bronze cannon. It fires balls that are 7 foot in circumference and can fire them over a mile. And so it was largely due to the constant bombardment of that cannon that the walls of Constantinople finally fell. And I tell that story in the book because, well, partly because it's, you know, it's kind of a good story, but partly because I think it was a real turning point where, you know, as I say, civilization's oldest security blanket is at last being torn away. And walls are, you know, at the beginning of the end of their usefulness in warfare.
And yet they never really go away. And bringing us right up to date, obviously there's a chapter in the book on the Berlin Wall, for instance, perhaps, you know, a wall that was more effective as a symbol than as an actual physical object. But right up to today, you know, there are walls being built in Palestine and across Europe. And I was in Calais a couple of weeks ago and, you know, witnessing the barriers that are built up around the port back into the UK to keep people from traveling. And,
you know, I've only read about that, Neil. What's the status of it now?
I mean, it's just obscene. As you are coming back from the city of Calais to the port to get the ferry across, miles away from the port, the road either side has walls and fences. I don't know how high, I can't guess, but, you know, with rolls and rolls of barbed wire all the way up to the port. I mean, it's a serious operation. It really is.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that. So it sounds like sort of an eyesore.
No, absolutely, yeah. And I've seen the wall in, I've been to Israel and seen the wall there as well that was going up around, you know, the entrance to the West Bank. That sort of concrete, you know, very quick to build, huge like concrete slabs that are put in. And so I guess the obvious other one to, you know, the other person to talk to here to finish it off is, you know, Donald Trump and his mad but obviously you know, deeply held belief in the ability to build a wall across America's southern border.
Oh my gosh, I thought if I crossed the Atlantic I could finally escape the Trump questions. I mean, just a word gets out, huh? Okay, so I'll be honest, I'm not expecting that wall ever to be built, to be honest. They've started some prototypes. I don't know how closely you follow our politics over here, but, you know, he's 2 years into his term at this point, roughly, and we're holding midterm elections. And usually, I think, if a president is going to carry out a major initiative, he tries to do it in the first year or year or two of his first term. And after that, things tend to slow down quite a bit. So I was a little bit surprised. It never seemed like Trump was pushing very hard for this wall once he was elected. And I know that some of his supporters viewed this as a bit of a bait and switch, but you know, it's almost as if he waxes hot and cold on this issue. And so, you know, now he's talking about, you know, when to start it up again, but we don't really even know what Congress is going to look like in a few weeks. So my hunch, you know, if I was a betting man, is that we're probably not ever going to see that wall.
Well, I think that's a positive point for us to end on. So I've been talking to David Fry. We've been talking about his new book, Walls, A History of Civilization in Blood and Brick, which is out in the UK now from Faber and Faber. David, thank you so much for sharing it with me.
Thank you for having me on your show, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.